Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how they affect our nation's future. We'll bring you the facts and some timely commentary from policymakers, experts, and grassroots leaders from across the country. This week, we'll be talking with John Lieber. John is the managing director of Eurasia Group's United States practice, leading coverage of politics and policy in Washington. Prior to joining Eurasia Group, John worked for a dozen years at the highest level of the United States government, including as an economist on the House Ways and Means Committee. They write the taxes, you know, an associate director at the National Economic Council at the White House, and a senior economic policy advisor to Senator Mitch McConnell. In these roles, John advised senior elected officials on a wide range of economic, fiscal, tax, trade, and financial services policy, and was a key Republican leadership staffer working on trade and the debt limit and keeping the government funded between 2010 and 2014. There was a lot of stuff going on. John has been in the room when major budget deals were negotiated, which makes him a particularly good person to talk to at this time. Concord Coalition Policy Director Tori Gorman will also join the conversation. John and Tori, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
John, you were here with us last September, and we were talking about the need for Congress to pass another economic relief package. And they certainly did, not right away, but they did another one in December, and then they followed that up with an even bigger one. Since then. So there's been plenty of not only economic relief, but money directed at defeating the virus directly. Before we get into proposals for where we go from here, I thought it'd be good if we just sort of look back at what's been accomplished with the American Rescue Plan Act. That's the big $1.9 trillion proposal that was just passed. And, you know, more specifically, what it portends for the future. What are some lingering questions that that come out of it? So let's begin there and just get your take on what are the most salient features of that plan?
Yeah, you know, the rescue packages that Congress passed over the last year have done it all. I mean, they've given support for small businesses, big businesses, individuals, families, the employed, the unemployed, schools, hospitals. Like, there's no aspect of society that hasn't been affected by these massive bills. And that's what happens when you spend over $5 trillion in 12 months. And the latest round was kind of more of the same, with some additional new wrinkles thrown in. So, you know, the biggest piece of this was the stimulus checks to individuals. And the first round was $1,200, then they did $600. And then they, you know, because of essentially the Georgia special elections and a promise made by former President Trump, they ended up topping up that $600 amount to hit $1,400 per person in a household. That's a lot of money. And that's starting to hit people's bank accounts now. For a family of four, that's over $5,000 if you're below the income thresholds. And that's going to start moving its way through the economy real soon. You know, there's some longer term, specifically coronavirus related spending in there. There's money for testing. There's money not only for school reopening, there's money to, you know, build new schools for the next decade. I mean, there's over $100 billion in school funding, which is a huge amount of cash for the federal government to give to the local governments to spend on schools. And then, of course, you've got things like unemployment insurance. There's a couple of new interesting, actually, income support programs, which represent expansions of existing income support programs, in particular, the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. And these were already, you know, these already went out to all taxpayers and were refundable. So even if you didn't have a taxable income, you still received the credit. But now for children under the age of five, the child tax credit is worth up to $3,600. So it's a lot of money to be putting in people's pockets. And the next phase of this process is going to be to try to make some of these provisions permanent. And I think that's going to be a huge focus for Democrats in Congress for the rest of the year.
So John, I had a quick question for you, if you don't mind. So the biggest bill before the American Recovery Act was the CARES Act we passed last year. CARES Act was about $1.7 trillion. And we passed that at a time when unemployment was about 14% and the economy essentially had crashed. Now the American Recovery Act was larger than the CARES Act, $1.9 trillion. It was passed at a time when the unemployment rate was about 6.2%. The economy had recovered a good chunk, you know, 60 to 70% of its GDP, real GDP, in the interim months since passage of the CARES Act. So I'm curious, you know, that the Recovery Act was so much larger than the CARES Act, and it was passed at a time when the economy was so much better than it was a year ago. Are you concerned about the outlook for inflation and higher interest rates and the potential for crowding out in the private economy, but also higher net interest costs to the federal government?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, I think that right now, you know, the evidence over the last 10 years suggests the U.S. economy can run pretty hot from a fiscal stimulus perspective. The U.S. can borrow a whole lot of money without breaking a sweat. You know, the U.S. is fortunate to have the reserve currency. It's fortunate to be a safe haven asset. Treasuries are fortunate to be a safe haven asset in times of distress around the globe. You know, when there's an economic downturn, you know, the investors globally still believe the U.S. has the best untapped tax base in the planet and is overwhelmingly likely to pay back their obligations. You know, this isn't Turkey. So I think that's a very good sign for the U.S. ability to finance fiscal deficits going forward, which is fortunate because the U.S. is running some pretty big fiscal deficits going forward. Mm-hmm. In terms of the inflation outlook, you know, I'm not an expert on inflation by any means, but there's been no inflation anywhere for the last 10 years, despite these big, you know, reasonable economic growth, large fiscal expenditures, like, for example, the Trump tax cuts in 2017. And, you know, probably due to some combination of globalization and technological advancement, inflation is just not really a problem right now. The Fed doesn't seem worried at all. Janet Yellen, the current Treasury Secretary, former Fed chair, has said that she's very confident they have the tools to deal with inflation should it come up. I mean, this is, you know, it should be noted, this is a grand experiment. Mm-hmm. No country at this large, this big, this important with a reserve currency has ever run at deficits of these size that are structural in nature and go out as far as the eye can see. So, I mean, you know, certainly I think it's a situation we'll have to kind of wait and see, but there is good reason to believe that in many ways, the inflation problems the US faced in the 70s have been tamed. There may be a new set of inflation problems that come about from the current alignment of macroeconomic policies that we just don't know about yet. And the only way to find out is to run the experiment and see what happens. Mm-hmm.
So that brings us to the next question is details have leaked from the Biden administration about a potential $3 trillion infrastructure plan moving forward. Some moderate Democrats are expressing concerns about cost and potentially paying for a new infrastructure bill. Democrats have shown some interest in raising taxes on high net worth individuals in order to raise the funds necessary. Republicans obviously show some reluctance to raise taxes. So that makes me wonder, are we stuck in a perpetual cycle of wash, you know, rinse, repeat reconciliation in order to get some of these pieces of legislation across the path? Or do you see the potential for the two sides to come together and actually pass something on a bipartisan basis through regular order?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it, wash, rinse, repeat, reconciliation. I mean, we're in a situation now where even when the parties agree on policies, they find a way to disagree over how to get it done. You know, an example I've been thinking about recently is the police reform, which, you know, last year there was a House bill, passed the House, Democrats controlled the House, Republicans controlled the Senate, Republicans put together a bill, and the Democrats, who were the minority party at the time, didn't agree with, you know, every single word on every single line, and so blocked it from passage. And that's probably going to be a dynamic you see unfolding this year on a China bill, which, you know, the Democrats are attempting to put together in the Senate. Republicans are, you know, they want to do something about China as well. But if they don't agree with every line, then, you know, it fails the purity test and they vote against it. And I think that's the dynamic with infrastructure as well. Now, obviously, the big exception to this was the CARES Act and then the follow along bill that happened at the end of the year, which was overwhelmingly bipartisan. That was a strange alignment because you had President Trump's reelection kind of in the balance, and it was an obvious economic emergency. But going forward and thinking about how this applies to infrastructure, you know, there's a lot of people have said for a decade that Republicans and Democrats both want to do infrastructure. And I think it was probably the case 15 years ago, there was a coalition of Republicans. They were part of what was called then the Pave America Caucus, which was, you know, dedicated to finding ways to finance road construction. And everybody likes road construction because it's good for, you know, it's a direct benefit that you can deliver as a member of Congress to your constituents. Chamber of Commerce liked it because it meant new jobs and, you know, infrastructure and all that. The thing that's changed in the last 15 years has been the total collapse, two things, the total collapse of the gas tax as a source of revenue to fund the Highway Trust Fund. So now if you did want to pave America, you got to find a new source of revenue for that. Republicans have been basically unwilling to look at any form of tax increase that would seriously finance a big new infrastructure program. The second thing is the increasing salience of climate change in the Democratic coalition. So while the Republicans kind of have more of a focus on cheap fuel, jobs in the oil and gas industry, Democrats, everything they do has to have this tinge, this green tint to it. And the green tint creates a partisan divide where the Democrats are going to use infrastructure as a backdoor way of forcing action on climate change, and the Republicans are going to say no. So I really don't see any room for overlap here. I mean, I think that it, you know, Biden has to say he wants to do something bipartisan. There's Democrats like Joe Manchin from West Virginia who want to be bipartisan. Members like being bipartisan, you know, they want to work together. But at the end of the day, the policy gaps are so huge, and the Democrats have the tool, reconciliation, to get the bill done without Republican input. So I think that's almost certainly where we're headed in this situation.
This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, your host, and I'm talking with John Lieber, managing director of the Eurasia Group and a longtime veteran of many budget battles on the Hill, and Tory Gorman, policy director of the Concord Coalition, also a veteran of many battles on the Hill. And we're talking about the latest COVID relief plan and how it will play into the budget and some of the very ambitious proposals going forward. You know, you were talking about reconciliation, and we're going to jump back into that, I'm sure. One of the issues is how many reconciliation bills can you do? I mean, there are so many big proposals, and it seems to me, as I recall, you can do one for spending, one for revenues, and one to raise the debt limit. And if that were the case, how much could they get into the Democrats, that is, if they chose to go the reconciliation route again?
So this is an interesting area where kind of the written letter of the law matters less than past practice. And, you know, yes, the Budget Act kind of lays out a process for doing one for spending, one for revenue, one for the debt limit. Past practice, it's really rare they split them up that way. And if you look at infrastructure, green energy incentives, healthcare, everything's a mix of tax and spending. So it's extremely unlikely they would actually split out reconciliation bills in that fashion. And if you look at the American Rescue Plan, that combined spending and revenues in a way, and that was the FY21 reconciliation bill. So you're technically allowed to do one reconciliation bill per fiscal year budget. And so what that means is that the kind of easiest path that is consistent with past precedent would be you do your FY21 budget, and then you do your reconciliation bill, then you do an FY22 budget, which the fiscal year starts in October, and then you do a reconciliation bill from that. And so that is a backdoor way of getting at two reconciliation bills in one calendar year, two big combo reconciliation bills. However, there's precedent from the 70s in the immediate aftermath of the passage of the Budget Act in 74, where Congress did multiple budgets. So there's nothing that's changed since that time that would prevent them from doing another FY21 budget if they wanted to, or another FY22 budget. So really the only limiting factor here is the politics. What do you have 50 votes for? What do the Democrats want to do? So I think, you know, a lot of people I talk to get really hung up on this idea that you can do two reconciliation. You can only do one reconciliation bill per budget. It's got to be. I think that all of that is just, you know, there's no point in getting so deep in the weeds. You just got to think about what's their political will to do. If they have to kind of set new precedent to do it, they'll find a way to do it. So I think that they could easily do a second reconciliation bill this calendar year. And if they really needed to and got desperate and the politics allowed for it, they could even do a third or a fourth or a fifth. That's very unlikely because breaking China, like breaking kind of presidential China, is unpopular. But that's, you know, that option is available to them.
John, you and I are thinking on the same wavelength. I tweeted about this morning, Section 304 of the Congressional Budget Act. Absolutely. Yeah.
I keep thinking as a lawyer that people are supposed to follow what's written. I keep forgetting if you have the votes, it doesn't matter.
Right. You also should know as a lawyer that it's the interpretation of the rules that matters, not the actual rules as written, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that brings me to another question then about the filibuster. We learned from experience with the American Rescue Plan Act that not everything can fit in reconciliation, right? They had to jettison minimum wage in order to get the bill through Congress. As they turn their attention to an infrastructure bill, especially if things have to have a green tint to them, as you were saying, to get something through a democratically controlled House and Senate, you know, things like environmental regulations don't necessarily have a place in a reconciliation bill. So if the Democrats are going to move their agenda through reconciliation, what do you think, or if they're going to try and move this legislation and it doesn't all fit into reconciliation, what do you think about the outlook for the legislative filibuster in the Senate, which requires 60 votes to end debate on a measure so that you can move towards a vote on final passage? Do you think that 60 vote threshold, that filibuster, remains, or do you think it's changed in some fashion?
I think they're probably going to change it this year. I think that there's enough pressure on them from what you point out, environmental regulations, maybe the minimum wage, or minimum wage doesn't have the votes, but environmental regulations, gun control, voting rights, all of these things are like massive priorities for Democrats that in some cases are existential for them. If they can't pass a Voting Rights Act that ends partisan gerrymandering in the House, changes the way campaigns are financed, and expands the availability of voting to kind of battle back efforts that are happening at the Republican state level, the Democrats aren't going to be able to hold their majorities. They're simply going to lose power. And if they lose power, they can't accomplish anything. So I think the voting rights in particular is a really acute need, and the Republicans are never going to vote for this voting rights bill. However, there are enough moderate members who not only currently oppose changes to the filibuster, but really have strong incentives to keep keep their opposition up. I mean, you know, you look at John Tester from Montana, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, they have voting bases that look nothing like the rest of the Democrats in Congress, because they rely on a lot of crossover votes. Manchin's in a Trump plus 40 state. So he's got a lot of Republicans to vote for him to stay in office. And he needs to maintain that independent brand, which means he can't sign up for the, you know, Elizabeth Warren blessed filibuster repeal plan. Mm-hmm. But they could find some other way to do it. They could implement the talking filibuster, which depending on how you do it, is either essentially full elimination of the filibuster by another name, or a nothing burger, which doesn't, you know, just kind of delay, is a delay, introduces a new delay tactic, but doesn't change anything. They could create new categories of exemptions through like a reconciliation-like process. So there's a new, you know, process to go around the supermajority requirement for voting rights bills or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's changes short of full elimination they could do. And right now, it certainly looks like they have momentum to get there. I just don't know what the issue is going to be that triggers it, and I don't know how far they're going to be willing to go at the end of the day.
Right. No, and well, that makes sense.
That's a good place to leave our listeners hanging on on that suspenseful note. We're going to take a brief break here and then come right back. This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby. I'm talking to John Lieber, Managing Director of the Eurasia Group, and Tory Gorman, Policy Director of the Concord Coalition. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, your host, and I'm talking with John Lieber, Managing Director of the Eurasia Group, and a veteran of many budget battles on Capitol Hill, and Tory Gorman, policy director of the Concord Coalition, who has had a number of battles on the Hill of her own. And we're talking about future battles to come on the Biden budget and some of the proposals that are going to be made. And John, one of the things that that has been enacted for 1 year as part of the last COVID relief bill was a major expansion of the child tax credit. There was also an expansion of the earned income tax credit and the child care and dependent tax deduction. So there's a sort of a suite of proposals that really provided a major boost to families for child care. Technically speaking, those expire after 1 year because they were part of a reconciliation bill. And so that's the way you write things. But it's clear that they were intended to be permanent and there'll be a major push to make them permanent. So that raises the question of how much would it cost to make them permanent? Because it is a very substantial new cost. And what are the chances that they would actually try to pay for it?
Yes, the two provisions you're talking about in the American Rescue Plan, which was the Biden, this $1.9 trillion stimulus, about $135 billion for this calendar year to go through the end of 2021. So if you just extend that over 10 years and assume, you know, don't give it any credit for inflation, well, let's give it a little bit of credit. You're looking at like $1.5 trillion or maybe even up to $2 trillion, which is, you know, that would be the largest expansion of the American welfare state potentially ever. I mean, these are huge, huge provisions. And they're very generous. $3,600 per child is a big expansion for children under the age of five. You know, they have the fiscal space to do it right now to expand them. I think the Democrats, you know, generally, if you zoom out a little bit, I think the Democrats sense that this is their big opportunity to legislate, given the likelihood they lose the House of Representatives next year in the midterm elections. And they're clearly in a position where they want to go big and bold. I suspect at the end of the day, $1.5 to $2 trillion is going to be—it's a bit rich for a permanent extension. But you know, the historical pattern in Congress is if you can't afford 10 years, take two. So I think that's probably where you're going to end up with in the infrastructure bill is you get a year or two of extensions of both of these programs plus the health premium tax credits that were also included in the rescue plan, and you know, call that victory and live to fight another day. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, John, we were talking earlier about, having to potentially reform the filibuster in order for Democrats to move the president's agenda through both houses of Congress. Here at the Concord Coalition, we try to be optimistic. We try to promote and be hopeful about bipartisanship because we think that bipartisanship is the only way you get, you know, long-lasting legislation. So that makes us turn our attention to the Gang of 20, which is a group of Senate Republicans and Democrats, 10 each, that have sort of coalesced around carving out a moderate agenda, or at least being able to affect the passage of moderate agenda in the Senate. In the past, you know, gangs haven't always worked that well in the Senate. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on the current membership in the Gang of 20, given that a couple of them, I think, are retiring senators, and their ability to actually affect the contours of legislation in the Senate and actually get bipartisan legislation done? Or is it just another fool's errand?
You know, I'm pretty skeptical. I'm like a gang skeptic as well. I'm pretty skeptical that the gangs make a difference. But there are examples where gangs have been effective. So the most prominent is the Gang of 14. I think 2005 or six. And it was when the Republicans were having trouble confirming their circuit court judges in the Bush administration. And the nuclear option was on the table back then. Majority Leader Bill Frist in the Senate wanted to blow up the rules to get Bush's judges done. And one of these gangs came together and saved the day and ultimately struck a deal that got confirmations done. Now that, of course, didn't last. We now have simple majority requirements for both executive branch nominees and judicial branch nominees going all the way up to the Supreme Court. But, you know, this gang of that formed last December kind of was, I thought also was somewhat effective. I mean, they basically pointed out to everybody, hey, look, you guys are over here and you guys are over here. There's obvious middle ground here. Let's just go there. And they kind of accelerated the process of getting a compromise. So, you know, I think that gangs, for the most part, members like to feel relevant. There's not a big committee process anymore. They don't have a lot of opportunities to offer amendments. So what they have instead are gangs. And you got gang, you know, known gang leaders like Joe Manchin, who's like the head bipartisan guy, because people want Virginia to know he's working hard to be friendly to Republicans. And that's really the main effect of the gangs, is to like signal that you're a reasonable person. In this case, the gang you're talking about, the Gang of 20, I actually think is meaningful, because the issue at stake is this issue of the legislative filibuster, which Republicans universally oppose. And, you know, I'd say you probably have 30 to 35 Democrats who probably vote to eliminate it today, and 15 to 20 who are skeptical. No, maybe let's call it 10 to 15 who are skeptical, and 5 who are opposed, who don't want to eliminate it, and aren't gettable. And I think that by ganging up with the Republicans and finding strength in numbers, they end up kind of insulating themselves, both by distinguishing themselves from like the overall Democratic brand that wants to eliminate the filibuster and will be painted as a more radical option. But they also really kind of, you know, defray some of the pressure they might feel from leadership, because now they're in a gang and they're strength in numbers. So I actually think this gang makes me a little more, pessimistic is not the right word, but a little more skeptical that they're going to reform the filibuster this year, because you have such a strong interest in preserving Senate traditions.
Got it. So shifting in the bipartisan sphere a little bit, there's been a development in the House and the Senate on earmarks. Earmarks are the practice that was abandoned many years ago about putting, you know, pet appropriation projects for your district in an appropriations bill. So in past practice, they've sort of been secret, airdropped in the middle of the night of a conference report, and then passed the next day on the floor. The House has already established a procedure for bringing the earmark process back for this coming fiscal year. And I'm wondering if the reemergence of earmarks in a more transparent world, that the House has outlined some pretty specific criteria about how these earmarks will be considered, both in terms of, you know, having to put your name on them and demonstrate public support back home, and everything's put on a website for everyone to see. So definitely some more transparency in the process now than in the past, perhaps. I'm wondering if that's going to have an effect on getting the government funded on time and via regular order, so that we're not stuck here on Christmas Eve waiting for Congress to pass, you know, an omnibus legislation with an entire kitchen sink worth of materials, provisions jammed inside. So do you see the potential for earmarks to have an impact on the appropriations process, or is it just kind of window dressing?
No, I think it's a meaningful advance. I mean, I'm basically agnostic on the earmark policy. As you both know, you know, the U.S. does not have a spending problem because of earmarks. The U.S. is a spending problem because we make entitlement promises that we don't fund with taxes. And that's why the country's got structural fiscal deficits. So, you know, to the extent earmarks get bipartisan buy-in, and to the extent that they can ease, I certainly think it's possible they ease the process towards getting either what I think is ultimately going to be an omnibus or a continuing resolution, or a cromnibus, a combination of the two. I think that probably makes that more likely. The problem with earmarks, though, is you've got, you know, Democrats are excited to do it. Democrats in the House, Democrats in the Senate are probably excited to do it too. They're probably very excited about the transparency requirements, because what's the point of getting an earmark for your district if nobody knows? So that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. The Republicans in the House voted maybe 2/3, 1/3 to bring back earmarks. But you're still going to have some members who want to vote, you know, vote no and take the dough, where they're going to be opposed to whatever the big porky earmark spending bill the Democrats want, but they want to get the earmark in. So that doesn't necessarily ease passage, doesn't necessarily massively grow your vote count in the Republican House, because of, in that Democratic House amongst Republicans, because of policy differences on the appropriations bills. But where you really have a problem is in the Senate, where you need 60 votes to get anything done. You need 10 Republicans, and they haven't yet convinced themselves that earmarks are a good thing. I don't think they can unilaterally disarm for much longer. I think that they're, you know, going to have to find some way to come to an accommodation on this issue. But if they did that, that would be very meaningful to me in making the appropriations process and the debt limit much, much easier this year.
This is Facing the Future on WKXL in Concord, New Hampshire. Bob Bixby here, and I'm talking to John Lieber, Managing Director of the Eurasia Group, and Tory Gorman, Policy Director of the Concord Coalition. And John, you mentioned one of my least favorite subjects, which is the debt limit. It's it's coming up again because it's so misunderstood and so misused, and it's the source of a lot of evil. But anyway, people think it controls the debt, and it doesn't. But the debt limit has been suspended for a while, and it comes back to life like Frankenstein's monster again this summer, and will no doubt play a part in budget negotiations. So, do you have any thoughts about how that might play out? I mean, is that just going to be rolled into a big bill and stuffed somewhere so that it appears like nothing happened?
Yeah, I was a little surprised the Democrats didn't do that on the rescue plan. I don't think I understand fully the tactical reason they just declined to do that on this last bill. But I assume that, you know, they feel like this should be a bipartisan thing and they want to make Republicans walk the plank with them. I'm not super worried about this for a couple of reasons. One is the politics around the debt limit have just changed. One of my last acts when I was a staffer in Congress was working for then Minority Leader McConnell in the Senate, who was facing a competitive primary in Kentucky in the early 2014, and yet, you know, voted along with 10 or 15 other Republicans for a clean increase in the debt limit because they just were so tired of fighting this out. And there was no blowback. There was no cost to be paid. There was no political price to be paid. So I think the politics around this have changed since 2011, when this first emerged as a big issue. But second, I think probably more importantly, is that Republicans are so concerned about preserving the legislative filibuster that I think on this issue, they're going to be on their best behavior. And because they know if you get into a showdown situation where you're truly threatening the default status or the credit status of the US government at, you know, midnight, 11:58 on the day before you're going to default, you're going to change the filibuster, eliminate the filibuster, and increase the debt limit. And that's not going to be a hard vote for Democrats because they're going to say Republicans are irresponsible. So I think that ultimately drives some kind of bipartisan accommodation. Maybe it gets done in the continuing resolution omnibus deal at the end of September. Maybe the Democrats have to slide it into their infrastructure bill if the timing works out. But I'm just not super worried about this year.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about the debt limit this year is that with the high burn rate, you know, monthly burn rate at Treasury because of all the coronavirus spending, we don't have nearly as much running room under extraordinary measures to delay any kind of legislation that would affect the debt limit, whether it's suspending the debt limit again or actually literally increasing the numerical limit in statute. So it's definitely something they're going to have to move quickly on, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've been looking for analysis around that, and I haven't seen a good estimate. But that's also what my understanding as well, is that, you know, you hit the thing on August 1st? Is that right?
Yeah, right. July 31st is when it comes back to life. Yeah.
And then the end of the fiscal year, which would be the natural deadline to do a funding bill, is September 30th. So you got 2 months. And I mean, the burn rate is crazy high. They also have a large cash cushion, is my understanding, that Mnuchin built up a large cash cushion in 2020 with a just kind of advanced borrowing, essentially, to pre-fund the coffers. So maybe that helps them get to the end of the, you know, get through a 2 month period.
Well, the other crisis that always comes up is the annual appropriations. And you mentioned September 30th, and we always seem to go through regular order. Now seems to be a continuing resolution on September 30th in lieu of a shutdown, and then some sort of CRs for a couple of months until they get things straightened out. Do you think that the regular appropriations bill this year will be any different? One thing that's different is that there are no budget caps. They've come off for the first time. So what's your quick take on how the appropriations process is going to go? And for our listeners, remember that we're only talking here about a third of the budget, or even less, about 30% of the budget, most everything else being entitlements and interest.
So my guess is, you know, the Democrats will have to roll out a budget in April or May. That budget will inform the infrastructure bill and will also include, you know, their levels to hit for the appropriations bills. I suspect the appropriations committees will try to do kind of a regular order process. I'd be really surprised to see that those bills move across the floor, especially in the Senate. And I think at the end of the day, you end up with a omnibus bill, which packages all 12 appropriations bills together. And that passes sometime in September. And then worst case scenario, you know, Bob, you go to what you said, which is a CR that kind of buys you a few extra months while you work it out for something in December. But I don't think, I just think regular order, to your point, is dead. And instead, you'll end up with some kind of big bill that passes at the last minute.
Seems to be a lot that I used to know about the budget that's dead.
Well, the Budget Act is so outdated.
I mean, the politics of it have changed so much, and the process has changed so much. It really is a different, we're in a new era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Budget Act is just dead. I mean, it's just irrelevant. I mean, it's relevant because it kind
of... It's got reconciliation. I mean, that's the only thing is that you need it for now is reconciliation.
Yeah. Yeah, and it constrains members what they can do, and it determines outcomes. But it's like it's failing at its original purpose, which was to create a rational budgeting process for Congress. And you know, the reason is that the members have no incentive to follow it, and they have every incentive to play out some other drama through the budget process. And that's what ends up happening.
Bob, this is a good case of where the politics trump the law, because the Congressional Budget Act does direct Congress; they shall pass an annual budget resolution, but. They've interpreted shall to mean, well, maybe.
Well, yeah, now it's a shall. And if you want a reconciliation bill, you shall pass a budget resolution. Mm-hmm. Other than that, don't worry about it. One other topic that has, the politics around this other topic have changed a bit too, and that's immigration. A few years ago, you could get a bipartisan majority, a fairly substantial one in the Senate, to pass a very sweeping immigration reform bill. And, now the politics of immigration are really, really poisonous, but the issues are still there. We still have a lot of undocumented people in the United States and a legal immigration system that doesn't really take full advantage of what it could do in terms of being a boon to the economy. Do you think there's any prospect of getting anything done on immigration?
So the House last week passed these two bills. One gave a path to citizenship for residents of the United States who were brought here illegally as children. The name they've been given is Dreamers. And then the second bill was a path to citizenship for agricultural workers. And I think it's interesting that Biden put forward this really big sweeping immigration reform bill on the first day in office. And that House is kind of like, nah, like that's all they could do was these two more limited bills. It just shows you how incredibly toxic this issue is in American politics. And so I think there's room for the Dreamers legislation. It's got a shot. There's certainly members like Lindsey Graham, Republican members in the Senate, like Lindsey Graham or John Cornyn, who support it. You know, you get to this issue where this dynamic we talked about earlier, where members can't agree even when they agree. So it's entirely possible that even the Dreamer supporters end up saying, "But I need to get something." And so the thing I need to get is mandatory use of the E-Verify system for every employee in the country. And the Democrats aren't going to go for that. Or maybe they're going to go for we have to keep funding the border wall or something like that. And so you get this overreach problem that ultimately makes it hard to accomplish anything. But, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, says that he's close to having the votes in the Dreamer legislation. I would probably bet against it right now. But I could see there being a world where enough Republicans coalesce around it to get something done this year.
Well, John, we're running out of time for this segment on Facing the Future. We certainly appreciate you coming back and sharing your thoughts on the budget process to come. Maybe sometime later in the summer when some of this plays out, we'd love to have you back again. And I'm sure there'll be some crisis from all of this that perhaps you can help us sort through. So we'll be back in touch with you and certainly appreciate you being with us again. And Tory, look forward to seeing you again back in the office at some point when we get when we're all fully vaccinated. You're listening to Facing the Future. This is Bob Bixby. I'll be right back with a few closing thoughts. Stay tuned. Thanks. Welcome back to Facing the Future. Here are some closing thoughts for the week. Last week, I got my second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. It got me thinking about where we were at this time last year and where things are headed now. At this time last year, COVID-19 cases were sharply rising. Many states were imposing tough restrictions on businesses, social gatherings, travel, and schools. The economy was plunging into a sharp recession, and the unemployment rate spiked to about 14% from 3.5% just a month earlier. Today, new cases have plateaued, albeit at a much higher level than a year ago. Many states are lifting restrictions. Some schools have reopened for in-person classes. Vaccines are being injected into over 2 million per day. The economy seems to be growing again, with most forecasters projecting an economic boom by the summer. And the unemployment rate has dropped to 6.2%. Now, make no mistake, the pandemic is still with us. It remains a threat to our health and an impediment to our economy. Perhaps there is a bit too much optimism about the near-term prospects, but there's no doubt there are signs of hope. The end is in sight, and we have a clear path for getting there, such as wearing masks, frequently washing our hands, maintaining social distancing, all those things we've been doing, all intended to buy time for the vaccines to take effect. On the fiscal front, however, it's a very different picture. A year ago, as the pandemic was first hitting us, the budget was on an unsustainable path. It still is. And unlike the pandemic, there is no end in sight, and there is no clear path for solving the problem. We can't wash our hands of it. Wearing a mask won't protect us from it. And unfortunately, there is no deficit vaccine. President Biden and Congress should keep all this in mind as they turn their attention from COVID relief to the regular budget and the post-pandemic economy. For the past year, we've lived with a deficits don't matter mindset. As the pandemic winds down, that mindset needs to change, particularly as we hear of major new spending proposals for infrastructure, climate change, healthcare, and more. If we want newer expanded programs, we should find a way to pay for them. In fact, with trillion-dollar deficits projected for as far as the eye can see, and long after the pandemic ends, we should find a way to start paying for some of the programs we already have, or at least bite the bullet and find some meaningful spending cuts. The time for deficit finance emergency spending is at an end. Going big to fight the pandemic made sense. Now it's time to start making some hard choices about the future. This is Bob Bixby. You've been listening to Facing the Future. See you next week.